Good morning. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, kpcc.org, and your smart speaker when you tell it to play KPCC. I hope you're having a good Tuesday. Coming up later this hour, our daily update on COVID-19. We have a lot to talk about, including a very inexpensive drug that in a clinical trial is showing real promise in the treating of symptoms related to severe COVID-19. We'll talk about that later this hour. But we begin with the latest on policing reform. Earlier today, just about 90 minutes ago, President Trump signed an executive order on policing, and he spoke at the White House Rose Garden with reporters.
Choke calls will be banned, except if an officer's life is at risk. And I will say we've dealt with all of the various departments, and everybody said, it's time. We have to do it. Additionally, we're looking at new advanced and powerful, less lethal weapons to help prevent deadly interactions. New devices are being developed all the time, and we're looking at the best of them. And cost is no object. No object. Under this executive order, departments will also need a share of information about credible abuses so that officers with significant issues do not simply move from one police department to the next.
These are a couple of reforms that advocates have wanted to see being made. However, there was the caveat on the chokehold about the life of the officer being threatened. A little bit later, we'll get into that in more detail. The president also drawing the line at defunding or dismantling police departments and replacing them with other sorts of response units.
But I strongly oppose the radical and dangerous efforts to defend, dismantle, and dissolve our police departments, especially now when we've achieved the lowest recorded crime rates in recent history. Americans know the truth. Without police, there is chaos. Without law, there is anarchy. And without safety, there is catastrophe.
President Trump drawing his distinction, of course, from the position that had been taken by police reform advocates. You've got in the House of Representatives, Democrats have put together a policing measure there under the leadership of Karen Bass of Los Angeles. The Senate GOP is apparently working on a version. With us to talk about what's happening on these various fronts is AP Chief Congressional Correspondent Lisa Mascaro. Lisa, it's good to have you with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Describe where the president's executive order fits versus Senate Republicans versus House Democrats. How is this all starting to shake out, if it is?
Yeah, you bet. So maybe we'll go quickly in a chronological order. The House Democrats, led by the Congressional Black Caucus, unveiled their proposal last week, the Justice and Policing Act of 2020. It is a sweeping proposal of potential reforms. They've laid down a marker on that. We can unpack it in just a sec if you want, but it provides a number of changes. It's headed for a House vote next week. Senate Republicans are quickly turning to this as well. Now, the Senate Republicans and the White House are working separately, but sort of in tandem. So they have what President Trump rolled out today with these executive actions that he's taking, and they dovetail and sort of align, maybe complement, different ways to say it, what Senate Republicans are proposing in their overhaul. Now, I will say right off the bat, you do have a discrepancy where Democrats are saying that their bill is just so much more robust than what Republicans are proposing. And so there is a standoff sort of emerging already, even when you include the measures that President Trump announced this morning. That said, I will say this is an abrupt and quick shift for Republicans, sort of long the party of law and order, as Trump likes to say, and others before him have said, really leaning in to some of these changes. In the end, the Senate Republicans and the Democrats from the House share a lot of common ground on a number of the broad strokes of what they're trying to do. There are differences in how they do it, and there are differences in how far the proposals go. But there are some areas of common ground, which I think are extremely rare in Washington, and a signal that, maybe there is something that can emerge here, all said and done.
It seems like congressional Democrats have been leery of adopting the term defund the police, that even as many of them support some money being reallocated from law enforcement to social services, that they're very cautious about the use of that term defund police. Is that a fair observation?
That is absolutely right. And even though you do have some individual Democratic members of Congress who would say they sort of support that, certainly leadership has moved away from that language and sort of instilled that that is not what they are trying to do here. Speaker Pelosi said that, basically those words. She said that has nothing to do with what we're doing here. Leader Clyburn, the number three Democrat in the House, has said on one of the Sunday shows, and again, he said again yesterday on a call with reporters, nobody's defunding the police. What the House bill does is provide some grant funding to local jurisdictions so that they could, investigate, look at different ways to sort of reimagine policing, think of, new ways to try out some things differently. I think the defund term has become sort of a political one that is being wielded against Democrats by the president, by Republicans. And, I think it's something that Democrats don't want to be necessarily sort of aligned with right now, even if in the end there is some common ground on that side too, where Democrats do want to sort of reimagine the way the police work and shift some resources, ultimately into some other community services.
It also seems like one of the differences in what Democrats and Republicans, it appears, are pursuing. Democrats want to see the full qualified immunity that law enforcement officers have in many states now, want to see there be a standard that is not as sweeping as they see it for providing legal protection to officers who are accused of abuse. And does it appear that would go anywhere in the Senate?
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. Just real quickly, the broad framework of both pieces of legislation appear that they're going to be centered in this idea of having a sort of database of police misconduct, use of force incidents, so that the public can be aware of who officers are when they transfer from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The House bill goes much further. It does include that language on qualified immunity. Now, some Senate Republicans are interested in that, and I believe that some of them might be unveiling their own sort of standalone bill on that issue, but that is not at all expected to be part of the Senate Republican package. And the White House has explicitly said that is a sort of line in the sand that the president would not support if he were to eventually support an overall bill. So it does seem that will be difficult. The House Democrats also proposed changing the federal misconduct statute to include the language reckless, behavior by police officers instead of just a sort of willful standard. That language I don't expect to be included in the Senate Republican bill. And so you can see where the Democrats are reaching farther at these reforms than the Republicans and the president are willing to go, even as they sort of work in a similar framework of trying to, you know, provide some transparency on who officers are and what kind of, you know, records they have.
Lisa, I appreciate it so much. No, you're extremely busy today with all that's going on. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Larry. Take care.
Thanks. Chief Congressional Correspondent for AP based in D.C., Lisa Mascaro with us on Air Talk. We have breaking news. Pacific Gas and Electric has confessed to killing 84 people in the devastating 2018 wildfire that destroyed the town of Paradise in Northern California. PG&E CEO Bill Johnson entering guilty plea on behalf of the company for the 84 felony counts of involuntary manslaughter. The fire blamed on the company's crumbling electrical grid. The admission part of a plea deal. It came during a dramatic court hearing this morning designed to publicly shame the nation's largest utility for neglecting its infrastructure. The name of each victim was read aloud in a courtroom before the Butte County Superior Court judge, while the images of the dead were shown on large screen. PG&E also pleading guilty to one felony count of unlawfully starting a fire. Again, PG&E has confessed in its plea deal with prosecutors to killing 84 people in the Northern California town of Paradise, which was wiped out by that devastating November 2018 fire. We're talking about the use of force proposals, the president with his executive order. Also, a proposal has been made by three of the largest police unions in California, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Jose. Robert Harris is director of the LA Police Protective League. Mr. Harris, thank you for joining us. First of all, your response to the National Database of Problem Officers and with the life in danger exclusion banning of the chokehold by the president.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry. Yeah, I'll start with the national database first. You know, San Francisco, San Jose, and the Los Angeles Police Protective League. We both included this in what we believe what is a good national standard, and that would be to create that database of officers who have been fired for gross misconduct, which would prevent them from being hired from other agencies. We don't want those types of officers within our profession. And when it comes to the chokehold, you know, it was already banned here in California and in Los Angeles in particular. It's not a technique that is used very often, but that technique is on the same level as deadly force. So if one of our officers was involved in a situation where they needed to defend their life or defend the life of somebody else, using a chokehold would have to be at that same level as shooting somebody. So I know it gets talked a lot about, but, you know, we've proposed some other significant national reforms that we've adopted in our own agencies that we think can really help to improve police and public interactions.
Mr. Harris, what about getting to the deeper level of community distrust, which we've seen exacerbated by some of the police tactics that were used in dealing with the protests, particularly the second night, the Saturday night, the use of rubber bullets, the use of batons against demonstrators in the crowd? You know, all of these things seem to further exacerbate difficult relations between the department you work for and particularly communities of color. What is the way of substantively addressing those concerns of members of the community that the LAPD has not built bridges enough and has acted in a way that's harmful to the community?
Yeah, I think the first place we start is I think we exercise some extreme ownership over our profession. And I think we get better at communicating with the public just how far our agency and our rank and file union has come. I don't think the public really understands that, you know, while everybody has been marching in the street for very good reason and calling for reforms, the Los Angeles Police Protective League, along with other rank and file unions in the state, walked the halls of Sacramento last year and helped to pass legislation that was landmark in requiring all agencies in California to adopt a minimum use of force standard. So our rank and file unions have moved beyond just talking And using platitudes, we've actually enacted legislation that has helped in our reforms. And a lot of the things that people are talking about, de-escalation techniques and tactics, rendering aid, duty to intercede, all of these things are already codified in our policies and we have been doing for a long time. Los Angeles has a great and robust early warning system to help identify officers early on who need training or mentoring before it gets to a problem of a disciplinary nature. So I would want listeners to understand that we want to see our profession professionalized. Our officers are some of the most professional in the country. And I think we can really take a leadership role on a national stage in these reform discussions.
So how does LAPD, though, reform itself with the proposals you're talking about, saying these are things that LAPD is already doing? Because there were policies about use of force, as I understand it, for crowds that, according to Chief Moore, it sounds like did not adhere to departmental policies. So if you've got policies that you think are sufficient, then how do you deal with what are the apparent cultural problems that lead to a lack of compliance with those standards?
Well, I think it's two-pronged. I think first and foremost, it comes down to leadership and training. And how are we training our officers? Are we getting enough training in these things so that they can execute based on the policies that we have in place? And then the other component for that is the significant and robust disciplinary system that the Los Angeles Police Department has. We have civilian oversight. Every complaint that is made is investigated and adjudicated all the way through the process. There are a number of review processes. So, you know, those things will play themselves out. I think it's important for people to understand that Los Angeles Police Department doesn't use rubber bullets. We use foam projectiles. We don't use tear gas. But, you know, if people have made complaints, you can be assured that those complaints are always taken and they are investigated. And look, if it's found that officers conducted themselves outside the lines, then, you know, then the appropriate discipline will be there. But, you know, on whole and on balance, I am proud of what our officers did over the last several weeks. I think they exercised a tremendous amount of restraint and professionalism.
Now, I think there were injuries from the foam projectiles, even if they weren't rubber. Isn't that correct?
Yes, I believe there were some minor injuries, yeah.
We're talking with Robert Harris. He's a director of the L.A. Police Protective League. Coming up, we'll talk with California Attorney General Javier Becerra, and we'll talk with the executive director of the Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. You're listening to Air Talk. We're talking about policing reform. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking police reform on the day President Trump issued his executive order banning chokeholds unless the life of the officer is threatened, also creating a national database of problem officers. With us now is California Attorney General Javier Becerra. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us again. What do you want to see as the ideal reforms for police, specifically when it comes to use of force?
Larry, first, thanks for having me. Let me put it this way. I think there are three branches of reform that we can undertake pretty quickly. One, dealing with use of force, so everything from calling on officers to prevent officer excessive use of force. From ensuring that we're reporting any use of force, stopping the chokeholds, those types of things. Then you have the area of bias, where we do the work that must be done to address bias in policing. And that can be everything from implicit bias, where an officer makes stops based on a person's race versus on known facts about any criminal activity. It could include something as unfamiliar to folks as bias by proxy. We saw something similar to what's called bias by proxy in New York, where the woman at Central Park called 911 because an individual who happened to be African-American was asking her to leash her dog in a place where she was supposed to have her dog leashed. And the third area is just in the area of accountability and transparency, making sure that every police officer is accountable, whether it's because you have a national database or because there are there will be disciplinary action if you are violating the practices and procedures that your agency calls for.
Is there a need for more transparency on police disciplinary action, including the identities of officers released earlier and information about what specific discipline has been issued in each case?
Every agency and every jurisdiction has its own set of processes to handle those, so it'd be tough to answer. Some have a more transparent process where they used a police commission, for example, to help process some of these cases. At the end of the day, most every agency would require some type of administrative proceeding. And so, Larry, that's a tough one to answer until you know what agency you're talking about. Some have been far more progressive than others.
We're talking with State Attorney General Javier Becerra joining us on Air Talk. In Los Angeles, as you know, Mayor Garcetti and council leaders say they're taking $150 million from the LAPD budget to put into community services. There have been activists who've been critical of police who say that an overwhelming majority of police funding should go into alternative approaches to answering calls for service and for being in communities instead of armed law enforcement officers. Do you support the redirection of those funds to do that?
Nearly 30 years ago, when I became a member of Congress in 1993 and 94, my first term, we had that major piece of legislation, the crime bill, which has been discussed oftentimes during the presidential debates. One aspect of that crime bill that never made it across to the president's desk was the prevention portion of that bill. It was supposed to deal with crime prevention, criminal apprehension, and criminal incarceration. The two parts that made it to the president for signature were apprehension, incarceration. The one that got dropped, didn't get the votes, was the prevention. And I think that's what you hear, whether it's Mayor Garcetti or others talking about, is how do you prevent crime and the types of activities you can invest in that help people from getting in a position where they've committed crime are what are essential. And so nearly 30 years ago, I was on record supporting doing crime prevention activities. So it's not just the 18-year-old who's about to engage in bad conduct, but it's getting the 8-year-old into programs that keep that 8-year-old from ever going in the wrong direction, because we want to stop this school to prison pipeline. And the way you do that is by giving young people, especially, a way to go elsewhere. And so I'm absolutely supportive, but it all depends on the program and what specifically you're talking about.
Do you support taking the money from law enforcement to do that?
It depends on what you're talking about. If it's crime prevention, there are certain programs that go work hand in hand with what the police are doing. But if you're going to tell me you're going to pull money from a public safety organization and not give them the resources it takes to do their work, I'd have questions. But I have a police, a law enforcement agency within the Department of Justice, the Division of Law Enforcement. We're the folks that collect the weapons from people who have lost the right to possess them. Felons and other dangerous people. If you were to tell me my agency was going to get cut because we want to move it into another area, might be worthy, I'm going to ask you, so how do I go out there and collect from the thousands of Californians who are no longer permitted to possess weapons? How am I supposed to go out there and collect those from them if you're going to cut my program? So I'd have to ask. I certainly believe everyone wants public safety, and we want to prevent crime from occurring, and there shouldn't be a reason why you can't do both. We can walk and chew gum.
I want to thank you for joining us, State Attorney General Javier Becerra. Just quick question, is your office reviewing the response by law enforcement officers to protesters in the state of California?
At this stage, we have not been asked to look at any particular case. We always take into account any requests that we get. We are, for example, sending investigators to review the incident where Robert Fuller was found hanging from a tree in Palmdale. And we are sending investigators to look into that matter.
All right. Thank you so much, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Javier Becerra, California Attorney General, with us on Air Talk. Also with us, the aforementioned Executive Director of the Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs, Jonathan M. Smith, led the civil investigation of the Ferguson Police Department after the police shooting of Michael Brown in 2014. He was with the Department of Justice at that time. Mr. Smith, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we have what the president announced this morning. We have the Democratic House proposal. Do you think that these various proposals or actions go far enough in reforming policing?
Well, I think that the steps that we're hearing coming from Congress, the Attorney General's proposal, the proposals we've heard from the police officers' unions that we've talked about earlier in this program, are very important. Although I think that they, in the main, are taking on some of the low-hanging fruit, some of the issues that for which people can act quickly, and are not necessarily bringing about the kind of fundamental change that communities are crying for that is causing people to walk out into the streets. A good example is the discussion you had earlier around chokeholds. Chokeholds, as a matter of law, are prohibited except when deadly force is authorized. The president, executive order today, and many of the bills that are being passed quickly in states across the country, banning chokeholds are simply restating what the law in many ways already is. The president's announcement to create a database on excessive use of force, that has been the law of the nation since 1994, and the Justice Department has had the obligation by statute to collect information across the country on excessive use of forces and just simply has never done it. So many of these changes are things that either are in place or have not been implemented by police departments. I am concerned that there's a rush to do the easy things, and some of those easy things are important but are not going to be anything close to enough. When we see people marching in the street after the death of Breonna Taylor or George Floyd or other people, people are marching because of those deaths, but they're also marching because of their daily experience with policing. You look at the practices around stop, question, and frisk. You look at the kinds of practices that have led to criticism of things like the gun recovery units that are engaged in jump out practices in jurisdictions all across the country and other sorts of practices. And unless we look beyond what is the most immediate causes of the demonstrations and deal with the over-policing and underserving of communities of color and communities in poverty, I despair that we're going to be here in another 5 years having this conversation again. This is not the first moment the nation has come to this conversation, and we have missed opportunities in the past. And I think that much of what we're doing now is rushing to demonstrate that we want to do something, but we're not taking the serious, hard steps that are going to be necessary to really fix the problem.
What would that look like specifically, what you describe as over-policing of communities? So what would it look like to undo that?
Sure. Well, I mean, Palmdale is a good example. We, when I was at the Department of Justice, we investigated the communities in Antelope Valley for a series of practices that where the law enforcement agencies had been collaborating with the Public Housing Authority to drive Black and Brown communities out of those neighborhoods. You saw in the wake of the Great Recession that there was foreclosures on housing, and housing became available, inexpensive housing became available in the high desert, and people moved into those communities from inner city Los Angeles. And you saw police that engaged in illegal stops and arrests. You saw police show up for Section 8 housing checks wearing with the housing authority wearing SWAT gear. You saw inordinate numbers of arrests, people afraid to go out on the street in the evening because they were afraid of their interactions with police. And we put in place there a consent decree, which required the police department to do a lot of things, to change its policies and its the practices regarding the enforcement of the laws in those communities, and Palmdale was one of them.
Is there a way to do that, though, before it reaches such scale that it gets reported on as it did in that case, and then the feds come in and a consent decree is issued? Is there some way of systemically and more consistently across the board dealing with that?
Yes, and I think that there were important steps being made at the end of the last administration that came to a halt when after the election. You saw the president's 21st Century Task Force on Policing issued extensive recommendations about what agencies could do across the country to take steps on their own without an enforcement action by the Department of Justice to bring about reform. There was work being done by the community-oriented policing service or office, the COPS office at the Department of Justice, to train departments across the country on things like problem-solving policing, on strategies around de-escalation. De-escalation is the policy of virtually every department in this country, but it is rarely enforced by any department. We're building national database on officers who have been disciplined in a national database of officers who have been discharged from positions, I think would go a long way towards helping with some of these problems. You saw, for example, the officer who was involved in the death of Tamir Rice had been fired from a prior department. Darren Wilson had been left a prior department under a cloud before the shooting of Michael Brown. So there are some very significant steps that can be taken. I think that, having a national policy on use of force is going to be helpful, but unless you have in place the adequate training of officers and, importantly, the adequate systems to hold officers to account to that policy, it's going to be very hard to make the kind of important changes that communities expect.
We're talking with Jonathan M. Smith, Executive Director of the Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. While with the Justice Department, he led the civil investigation of the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department after the police shooting of Michael Brown. That was back in 2014. In San Francisco, the mayor has ordered that police not respond to non-criminal calls for assistance. So this might apply to neighborhood disturbances, issues revolving around homelessness, domestic disputes. Do you think that is a sound public practice?
Yeah, I strongly support the strategies that are being begun to be implemented and that people are talking about to use non-police responses to issues in communities. We have a crisis in this country of an absence of adequate mental health services. And when someone goes into crisis a family member or a loved one calls about someone in crisis or a neighbor calls about someone that they're worried about, sending a police officer is in many ways absolutely the wrong person to send. It's not fair to the officer. The officer may have some training on crisis intervention, but they're not a mental health provider. It's a dangerous situation for the officer because their strategies to engage the person are law enforcement strategies, not mental health strategies. It's dangerous to the individual. We see far too many people in crisis get injured or die at the hands of police in those interactions. We should be sending mental health workers to resolve those problems. We should be supporting violence interruption programs, which have proven to be successful around the country, where trusted members of the community are trained and supported to intervene to prevent violence from happening rather than a law enforcement strategy, which goes in after violence and engages in a punitive approach to violence intervention. Teaching young people how to be peer interveners and to support good behavior, getting police officers out of schools and then replacing those with peer intervention programs and reinforcing the role of teachers and putting drug treatment and family support programs in schools is a far more effective way of creating community in schools. So I think there are a broad range of alternative approaches that can be taken to deal with the kinds of issues that police are dealing with now.
Mr. Smith, I want to thank you for being with us. We appreciate it. Jonathan M. Smith, Executive Director, Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. Let me go back to L.A. Police Protective League Director Robert Harris. I wanted to ask you about San Francisco's approach. Is that something you would support in Los Angeles, officers not responding to non-criminal calls?
Yeah, I think it's a worthy conversation to have. And it's a conversation that the Protective League has tried to be engaged in for a while now. And that is really talking about, do we refocus the efforts of our police officers? Look, in Los Angeles right now, 980,000 calls for service happened in 2019. Now, how many of those necessitated a real law enforcement response? I think that should be looked at. And in Los Angeles, we are already not meeting our response times to 911 emergency calls. We already have a difficult time following through on investigations of violent crimes and property crimes. And if you're a resident and you come home and your Amazon packages have been stolen off of your porch, you want the police to come and you want them to respond in a timely fashion and investigate that. And right now that doesn't happen. So if we want to begin to look at what our communities expect us to engage in, we're open to have that conversation.
Are you open to some of the funding that's used for responding to those nearly million calls a year going to those kinds of interventions, be it mental health or people trained to deal with domestic disputes who are not sworn officers?
Absolutely not. When it comes to the budgeting thing, look, our elected officials here in Los Angeles have placed society's issues at the feet of law enforcement. And now they want, and that was the path of least resistance. And now when it comes time to looking at maybe not having law enforcement respond to those things, the path of least resistance is to try to cut our budget. And anytime you start cutting public safety budgets, you have a real tangible impact on our ability to provide public safety. Chief Moore just came out and said, if we have to do these budget cuts, we will slow down hiring and not hire to our attrition rates. So you are looking at a domino effect where a year from now, we will have 500 less officers on the street. 2 years from now, we may have 1,000 left. And we have the World Cup and the Olympics coming to Los Angeles. If you look at the people's budget that was presented to City Council, they want to take the Los Angeles Police Department down to 900 officers. That is just a punitive approach to this topic and doesn't bode well for real leaders to try and solve problems.
Speaking of Chief Moore, he'll be with us for an entire hour tomorrow on Air Talk. We'll discuss use of force issues, police reform, all the issues that we've been talking about, and additional ones. That's tomorrow on Air Talk. LAPD Chief Michael Moore joining us for a full hour tomorrow morning. My thanks to Robert Harris, LA Police Protective League, the union representing LAPD officers. They've joined with San Jose and San Francisco police officers. They've issued their reform proposal. And of course, we have multiple ones, including the president's executive order on policing that was signed today. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back with our COVID-19 daily update in 90 seconds.